Welcome to the Creative Magic Podcast. I am your host, Lucy H. Pierce, and creativity is at the heart of my life as an author, visual artist, editor, and creativity teacher. I've always been fascinated about the creative process and those who dedicate their lives to it. So join me and my guests, writers, artists, creatrixes, magical women, for profound and practical conversations about what creative magic means to us. I've got a couple of new classes coming up. If you're interested in my creative process, how I work and how I've put together, especially in my most recent book, Crow Moon, the words and images and how I work between the two. So I'm sharing a masterclass on April the 25th, a 2-hour long Zoom masterclass where you can join me live to learn many of the exercises, rituals and techniques that I used. If you can't make it live, you will receive a recording of it as well as some course notes and the playlist. So you can buy that as a standalone, or you can receive it completely free if you sign up to the 4-week word and image course, which is a deep dive into how I use word and image and how we can fill the gaps between the two sides of the brain, the left side and the right side, these two ways of knowing, and make your creative process much richer and more enjoyable. You don't need to be an established writer or artist. All of my courses are suited from absolute beginners up to professionals. You can tap in whatever level you are at now. This has been an extremely popular course that I've run many times. And so if you sign up to that, as I said, you get the masterclass completely free. That starts the 3rd of May and runs for 4 weeks. You can buy both on womancraftpublishing.com on the shop. I do hope you'll join me. I'm joined today by Reverend Dr. Sushmita Mukherjee, writer, artist, educator, and spiritual companion in the interspiritual tradition. She is an ordained interfaith minister, as well as an associate professor in a large medical college in New York City. Her vocation straddles cutting-edge biomedical research and a spirituality imbued with magic and wonder. Her psyche thrives at the interface of image, imagination, and creative innovation. Her spiritual work draws on Eastern and Western myths, earth-based traditions, Taoism, Sufism, and perennial philosophy. Her work is deeply influenced by the teachings of Carl Jung and James Hillman. Some of her interests include myths, dreams, poetry, and art, including Jungian-influenced dreamwork, soul collage, and chakra dance. Our conversation started in the dark woods of the psyche. We discussed the problems of how we talk about darkness within Western thought. We discuss individuation, a mainstay of Jungian thought, and why it's problematic and why it's necessary. We discover shared loves, including Mary Oliver, Jung, Krista Tippett, and John O'Donohue. She speaks about a book that she's currently reading called Hospicing Modernity that I went straight out and bought. She also discusses how she discovered the beauty of our biology. And we finish on nature and privilege and finding the wild in the heart of urban spaces. We were really a meeting of minds and souls in this conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as much as we both did. Welcome, Sushmita. I am so delighted to have you with me today for Wild Initiations.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's wonderful. It's wonderful to meet you like this.
I know, right? Because I only know you through your words. So I discovered you online when I was researching
A specific part of Crow Moon, which is where I want to dive into with you today. So the part is about the dark woods. So Crow Moon is about real life crows, birds and trees, but it is also, and more importantly, about this adventure that many of us have, especially in midlife, through the dark woods of the psyche. So I want to just read you a little bit from it so that you can kind of get your bearings as to my thoughts and how I was quoting you. Crow Moon is not only about our adventures in the outer woods, but the trek through the shadowy places within ourselves to encounter the unknown or rejected aspects of the self. Since ancient times, writes Bruno Bettelheim, the near impenetrable forest in which we get lost has symbolized the dark, hidden, near impenetrable world of our unconscious. The dark wood is a powerful metaphor. We instinctively understand both from lived experience and cultural narratives, most commonly myths and fairy tales. Being lost in a dark wood speaks to the sense of bewilderment and confusion that we experience, and the corresponding inner experience of trying to navigate internally when we have lost our bearings. This encounter with the dark forest within tends to happen at moments of immense inner and outer change, most commonly in the transition of midlife or at any time of the death of a significant person in our lives. The self we once thought ourselves to be no longer functions as it once did. We often find that we neither recognize the person we have become nor the roles we are inhabiting. This sense of inner dislocation often seems reflected in the world beyond our bodies. In the wise words of interfaith minister and spiritual counselor, Reverend Dr. Sushmita Mukherjee, the dark forest is indeed an encounter with the end of a phase of life and an invitation to what Jung called individuation. The integration of opposites, of no longer shoving things we didn't like into the unconscious or projecting it onto other people. Until we enter the dark forest and lose the straight path ahead, we can be assured that we have been traveling the communal path, the path chosen for us by our family, our teachers, our institutions, our society. But as we enter this dark forest, we are finally confronted with the potential of our own unique selves, our very own flavor, our very own color. I love this. Our very own taste. To the extent that we are then able to find our path out of this dark forest, though its many false turns and hidden snags and snares, we start to become truly ourselves. So those last words were Sushmita's. So Sushmita, would you like to take us on from there, expand on that, dive deeper, pick out bits?
Sure. Sure. So a few things that come up for me as I hear you read that. And the first thing that comes up in me is a little bit of a cringe, because I feel like this was written several years ago. And that my journey has actually taken me on a little detour, which is totally how, sorry. Yeah, totally how it should be.
Absolutely. Right?
So I am actually less sure as I live longer whether individuation is necessarily our life project. In the sense that I've been doing a lot of reading and thinking about interconnectedness and interbeing and this whole idea of I am because you are. And that we depend on not just other humans, but other species and the interconnected web of life to live. So this whole idea of individuation feels like a rather Western kind of enlightenment humanism perspective that doesn't ring as close to my heart as it used to, even a few years ago. I mean, I'm surprised to see how much that has shifted for me as I hear you read this piece. I think it is still very important to enter unknown places, absolutely. Also, the word dark has become a really interesting kind of ignition place for me to do exploration, because I am realizing how one of the gifts of this Enlightenment humanism perspective is binaries. We've been taught and socialized to think in binaries. So we have light and dark, good and bad, God and devil. And then we're kind of told, okay, and then we put kind of morality on those. So it, to be in the light is moral and good. To be in the dark is bad and scary. And I think that there might be, I think this kind of binarization and putting values on the binaries might have led to things like racism in our psyche, because we have said, oh, dark is unknown, it's dangerous, it's bad.
I wrote a lot about that in Burning Woman, kind of unpacking those binaries and how dark is bad. Mm-hmm. And also the feminine is bad.
Exactly.
And, you know, so often the two get kind of put together. And so how can we envision another sort of darkness that isn't exactly a bad darkness, but actually is a darkness of rich, life-giving, life-affirming, mm-hmm. the unseen and unknown of all things, but it yes. being a wonderful thing.
Yes, a womb and a tomb.
In Cro-Moon, the darkness certainly is, there is a binary to it because it's in images. And so it is black and white images. And so that black and white is really played with in a very interesting way, because every time something crosses from white into black, we see this mirror image, we see this interplay, we see this kind of the unseen kind of being revealed. So I was very playful with it in that kind of that sense of seeing deeper, seeing in other ways when we kind of move beyond just the binary and actually see, we'll have to go backwards and forwards, through and round between them.
Absolutely. No, I love that. And one of the things that I've been, so I've been teaching on shadow quite a bit in the seminary. And one of the things that I invite students to do is to think of, so play with the words shadow and shelter and like protection, because shadow is, it can be a quote unquote negative thing, but it can be also a place of rest and restitution and shelter. And I think of John O'Donohue and how he invokes shelter in such a beautiful way, like hospitality of that sheltered place. And
I'm glad I've discovered another John O'Donohue fan. I mean, I know
I love him.
I know he's not kind of like hidden. I know he's very popular, but he's so special, isn't he?
He is. He totally is. And so again, and this, the other thing that I was going to say is, I've been inviting students to kind of went to think about this place that's at the bottom of the well, and sometimes you can use the metaphor of the womb and the tomb, because those are the two places where you're really at the bottom of the well. And it's not, I mean, it is mysterious and it is unknown, but maybe we can take one more step further and say it's unknowable. And how does that my ego respond to that? It's unknowable. No matter what efforts I make, it's above my pay grade. I cannot know. what that mystery is.
And for me, that's another, the thing about the darkness is, and this is using that the very much the Enlightenment project of rationality and understanding with the rational mind. So darkness is the opposite of that, as yes. in you cannot know with the rational mind. You have to move into it with feeling, with intuition, with senses. You cannot know it.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's what we would do if we were in a dark forest, right? Yeah. We would feel the texture of the trees. We would feel what's under our feet. We'd probably take off our shoes so we have better sense of what's under my foot and what's the temperature like and what am I smelling, and then try to decide what kind of trees are around me. So, yeah, so I think one of the invitations of entering the dark woods is entering this place of full embodiment.
Yeah, the fullness of ourselves, including the animal self, the exactly. instinctual self, rather than just the socialized human self, the modern
exactly. human self.
And that is so exciting and so terrifying, because we don't get taught that in our culture.
Nope, we don't.
There's no place you go to learn that. There's no encouragement to do that. And so when that comes knocking at your door through illness, crisis, midlife, through some sort of what I called wild initiation, mm-hmm. it can be terrifying.
Absolutely. And it is an invitation into a whole other way of being, if we are able to cross that threshold, if you're able to hold on. And I wonder whether that's where things like faith and trust live. As I don't know. I don't know what's beyond, but I choose to trust that there is something beyond. That's letting me, that's motivation enough for me to keep feeling in this place where my dominant sense doesn't work.
Exactly, exactly. And so for me, I navigated that place of darkness, of not knowingness, through images. Mm-hmm. Because usually language falls away at that point.
Exactly.
The rational mind falls away, language falls away. What are we left with? We're left with feeling and images from mm-hmm. very deep, strange places within us.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm definitely like, among the, you know, Matthew Fox's ideas of the via positiva, via negativa, mm-hmm. via creativa, and via transformativa. These are his four kind of entrances into mystery. And I feel like for me, via creativa is my place. It's like the place that I naturally go to. So working with images, I do a lot of soul collage, I do other kinds of things, movement. Those are all ways of, because I mean, just like everybody else, I used to say I have a shutter at my throat, and the shutter was mostly closed and I lived neck up the first half of my life. So that's a much more well-trained, the grooves are much deeper. I know how to think my way out of most things. But when I can't think my way out of something, that's when. So again, like I have to be forced often, even to this day, it's less and less because I'm more conscious of it. But I still can see how it's natural for me, or it's instinctive for me to go towards, let's think it out. Let's find what's the rational solution to this. And when that doesn't work, like raising a interesting, wild teenager, you start to go into the other senses.
And so I'm just so glad I get to talk to you about this, because when I read your bio, I was like, oh my goodness, she is such a kindred spirit. And all the things you loved were all the things that I love. And I don't come across people that often who tick that many boxes. So tell me, how did you, because I was also very academic, and I know you still work in academia. So how did you move into accessing images and that? Because I think there'd be a lot of people listening to and watching this who really identify with that, being stuck in your head, trying to rationalize, trying to think things out, and that's not working. But they don't know how to do the next step, how to find the images, meet the images.
Yeah, it's interesting. And yeah, okay. So let me kind of speak what's arising in me, because I don't think I have an answer really, but let me speak. So my background, my PhD was in biophysics and doing spectroscopy. So there was already this little piece of interaction of light with matter that was kind of the space. And then as in my postdoc, I started working in cell biology and working more with microscopy, so microscopes, and looking at what's happening in the cells under microscopes, with microscopes. Actually, we almost never look under the microscope, maybe the first 2 minutes, and then it's all on the computer screen. But so it is. But I think I really kind of fell, so early on in my postdoc, which is 20 years ago almost, I really fell in love with how our bodies are so beautiful on the inside. Like how a cell moves, how it navigates, how it communicates with another cell type. And then I remember this kind of almost an epiphanic moment that I had, is I was collaborating with surgeons and pathologists, and we were trying to find a way to kind of avoid. So it's called optical biopsy, in the sense that we were, the plan was to create a device so you could bring it close to a place where, for example, you might have a tumor, and to see whether it's benign or malignant without having to remove it, without having to take a biopsy. So that's the optical biopsy piece. That was the research I was involved in for many years, which I don't do that anymore. But this was the first time I had been in a cystoscopy suite. So cystoscopy is imaging of the bladder. And I kid you not, we are there, and my friend, who's the urologist, who's put the catheter in, the cystoscope in, and we are seeing the cystoscope move through the urethra into the area of the bladder, and moving around, and there's like a lot of saline swishing there and so forth. And you start to see the bladder wall, and then suddenly this tumor comes into focus, and these are called exophytic tumors. So they're like, so exo is out, and phytic is like strands or branches. So it's like a flower blooming out of the bladder wall. And when that came into focus, I don't know, it was an epiphany. I can't use another word. It's like, this is tumor. It needs to be taken out. It's not good for the person who has it. And it is so beautiful. It is no different from looking at a National Geographic video of life in the oceans. Because it also had the water flowing, the saline washing, and it's just extraordinary. So I think that kind of, I always liked things that have beauty, not necessarily beauty in the pretty sense, but really beauty. And then that kind of fixed it for me in some ways. And then, so that was one piece. So I started to really appreciate the beauty of my biology. And then I was also, as a young person, I'd been interested in spirituality. I had had the usual experiences of like, oh, you ask too many questions, don't bother me, all those things. And so I was looking for some way to get back to spirituality, and I didn't know what would work. And I had read the Tao of Physics when I was 16, and that like blew my mind.
Well, I was 18, but yeah.
So around that time, somebody introduced me to Joseph Campbell and his comparative mythology. And through Joe Campbell, I got to know about Carl Jung. And I was like, okay, this is it. This is my ticket through the back door to enter the space of soul and psyche as soul.
Mine
and
too.
Not just psychology.
Mm. But not leaving out psychology
not
either.
Exactly, yes. Exactly.
You got to have all worlds. You got to have symbolism and art. You got to have religion. You got to have science and psychology. And
exactly, exactly.
Yes.
I have a good friend who once was just joking, at least in this country, said we started by doing psychoanalysis. Then we did psychodynamic. Then we did mental health. And now we do behavioral health. And the point is, as long as you can function in society, we don't care what's going on with you.
Yeah. We don't want to go deep. We just want to fix the surface as best we can and off you go. Function.
Exactly. So I think in some ways what some of us are waking up to, and it's always wonderful to meet somebody like you because it gives me hope that there are enough of us who are kind of starting to say, oh, wait a second. Is this project of modernity really what I want to sign on to? You know, lately I've been reading, and you can edit this out if you want, but lately I'm deeply, deeply, deeply immersed in this book called Hospicing Modernity. It's a book written by this woman, Vanessa Andreotti. Gorgeous, gorgeous book. And I can kind of get carried away with it. But the essence of the book is, for the first time, I heard somebody lay it out so clearly that what we understand as modernity, and she often uses modernity / coloniality, not colonialism, but coloniality as a mindset, that maybe it is time to hospice this. And what really touched me was she was talking about, if you think of modernity as a being, as an embodied being, that it's an elder. And if we are able to hospice its passing, then we can both learn the lessons that the project of modernity, or what I call Enlightenment humanism, has given us, and also learn the mistakes that it made, that just like we learn from an elder who's dying in our lives, right? And because, I don't know, my gut tells me that this whole project is flawed at this point. Not that it never should have been done. I think it had its place. And I think we're kind of running out of this storyline.
I love that idea of hospicing it because it feels very respectful and caring and compassionate. For those of us who know that this project is finishing, but that something more wonderful could happen afterwards, there's always this question of, but how do we get from here to there?
Exactly. Exactly. And this entire book is about, like, there's a lot of exercises and stuff. And in fact, one of the really funny things, I've never seen a book like this before, ever, where maybe the first 1/10 of the book or so, there comes a point where she says, okay, so these are the different relationships that people can have with the project of modernity. And if you are not here, then maybe it's best for you not to read this book and to gift it to somebody else. And I think that's a really smart thing to do, because I think only some people are ready to start this conversation. But I also feel there are enough of us. It's not a zero-sum game.
No.
Are we too late to have the conversation? I think the planet is going to be fine. Gaia is going to be fine.
It will just be different. But whether it will be hospitable to
humans. Whether we will be there.
Yeah. Yeah. She will figure herself out, and she will rebalance and find equilibrium, and you know, have a new life.
Yeah, but, and maybe a species that's more more wise.
Yeah. When you were talking about the individuation project as being something that you thought was kind of has had its time, part of me really agrees with you. And I was certainly kind of toying with that as I wrote the book. But this is where I kind of ended up, which is that I think we need to individuate from what we were told that we have to be, the lives that we are told that we have to have, and to reconnect with our own soul's purpose, longing, and in that sense, become aligned with ourselves.
Yes.
And then we absolutely need to integrate with species beyond ourselves, Gaia as a whole, so that we are living as we are supposed to live as creatures on this planet.
Cannot agree more. In fact, I often think about like the analytical and the synthetic aspects of inner work, whether you call it spiritual, whether you call it psychological. We have to do some of the analysis first. We first have to remove what's no longer working, you weed the garden, and find who I really am. But then if we stay, my problem, and I see that a lot in the Western cultures especially, is that then I become a navel-gazing, oh, look at me.
Yeah.
And that's where I think if we don't move on to the we at some point relatively early in the process, then it can become a self-aggrandizement without a lot of, the process stops.
100%. Yeah. And for me, that is what wild initiation is about, because we are being reintegrated into our rightful position as being a very small part of a very complex and incredible creation of which we are tiny, tiny. And it's that sense of getting enough kind of self-esteem to know who I am and I deserve to belong and all of that, so that we're not just kind of wiping ourselves away or kind of playing into victim and perpetrator and all of that. We're getting rid of that bit, but then we are seeing ourselves as we really are, which is very small bipedal creatures in an incredible creation of all different sorts of life forms, which are interacting, interplaying, and not just on a biological level, but on a soul level, on all sorts of different levels.
Absolutely.
And so it's understanding ourselves within that context, which again, we're not taught in our culture.
Not at all. In fact, I love this because, yeah, as you say that, it's not just this interconnected world, but it's also the world of the ancestors, the spirit beings, the spirit guides. I mean, there's no limit to how far we can expand it until we get to these places where I can't see right now. But just because I cannot see, so the old rational model will tell me if I can't see, it's not there. And I'll say, maybe there are fairies. Maybe there are, who knows? I don't see them, but there are other people who do.
And it's leaving space for that unknown, for that unseen, in a respectful and just, and that might be true too. Whereas the Western mind very much is, can't see it, isn't there, science doesn't say, so no. And I don't think that helps us. It doesn't help us to be humans with each other, of people with many different diverse experiences, beliefs. And it also doesn't help us to expand our perspectives, because we're always just, you know, focused on the things that we're told we're allowed to believe.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's my experience and my felt response is, as we kind of start to slough off the the skin of modernity, if you will. That's the word that I'm loving these days. I think it's really important to find community. It's really important to find, like the conversation that we are having right now, we hadn't met until this moment. And it feels like I know you, because I do. And that's because otherwise I think I would lose faith, because I'm constantly teetering on this hope and despair seesaw. Because sometimes it just feels like our species is just doomed. I mean, there's no way. But other times it feels like, no, there is some hope. This conversation is happening in many, many small groups. And maybe sometimes I think about this, like maybe what might be one model of a future would be these small kind of groups that then interconnect and interweave rather than one large, the mega story, what Joseph Campbell used to call the monomyth, I mean, which is the hero's journey, right? Which is what we've been living for the past, I don't know, 200 years at least, not more, maybe more.
And it's not working. Like, just to give the example of the US, like, you have two such divergent opinions that cannot possibly coexist. They can't find compromise. They can't find any middle ground. And it's like, how do you move forward with that?
Yeah, then it's really that seesaw that I'm in my echo chamber and I only interact with people who think like me and who talk the same language, and the other world is in their echo chamber. It's like two balls, like two transparent balls that are kind of banging against each other, but there's no hyphae, no mycelia connecting those two.
Oh, it's lovely that you mentioned the mycelium, because that for me was one of the starting points of the book. Was, you know, you said one of yours was looking under a microscope. For me, it was seeing a Petri dish with mycelium that had been grown out on it and the patterns that they made, and just having to draw that and engage with what that branching felt like and how it happened, and the fact that it goes on unseen under the forest floors and yet has only just so recently been discovered and is so vital to the well-being of so many organisms in a forest.
Yeah, and that's also what makes a forest one living creature. Right?
Which we don't see, because we just see trees that can be chopped down and, you know, made into things.
Yeah. Yeah. Another book that really kind of moved me earlier this year was Overstory, which is a book that I'd been kind of holding on to. I started reading it. I couldn't get into it.
I started it and left it after a while.
And then I got into it and I just couldn't put it down after that. It was just like it took on a life of its own. But maybe when the first time I tried, I wasn't ready. I hadn't done whatever work that I needed to do to be able to receive the story.
I often find that with books. I, you know, you like the idea of it, but there is something that you don't know yet that you need to know, or a place you need to be in before you can enter the book.
Yep. So, yeah, I often say like this book is working me. And I really feel that, like with Hospicing Modernity right now, I feel like it's working me rather than I absorbing it.
Mm. Tell me, do you live in New York City?
I do.
So how do you access nature? And what part does nature play in your life, in your spirituality, in your creativity, bearing in mind you live in a city?
So I am, again, very lucky and privileged. That's I really want to name that, because that's one of the things that I'm learning from one set of languages from Hospicing Modernity that's really speaking to me is how she talks about. So, you know, there is the concept of the first world, the third world, developing world, developed world. She prefers the global north and the global south. Because one of the things that she does is she says, then you can start talking about the north of the north, the south of the north of the north being the privileged in the privileged world. South of the north would be like South Bronx or inner city Detroit in the US, where these are the least privileged among the privileged. And then you have the north of the south and the south of the south. So I would, so if I put that context, then I think I grew up in Delhi, born in Calcutta, grew up in Delhi. So I think I was like, not quite south of the south, but like equator of the south, maybe, is where I started. And now I really honestly believe I'm north of the north. And with that comes a lot of privilege and really this question of what do I do with that privilege? How do I don't know, feed it back into the ecosystem. But to answer your question, I know I went kind of on a detour, but to answer your question, I live actually not on Manhattan, but on this place called Roosevelt Island, which is this tiny, tiny island between Manhattan and Queens. So it's just like a mile long and like maybe a quarter of a mile wide. And so where I live, I live on the 16th floor. It's an apartment building. Stand at my window, I see a river constantly in movement. And I have a relationship with this river because it's called East River. And when I really started to be drawn to this river, I did a lot of reading, which is the intellectual part of me. And one of the things that really struck me is East River is not even a river. It is actually an estuary. It's a brackish estuary that connects Hudson River with the bay. So I live on an island which is on both sides we have rivers because it's in the middle of the East River. We have old trees that have been there forever. There's a lot of open spaces. So nature is very present, although I can look out my window and see where I work across the river, which is in Manhattan and just like concrete jungle. So, and that's a very interesting piece that again brings me into the social activism piece, or maybe not so much activism, but the social awareness piece, because I know that in urban context, to have access to nature is a direct sign of privilege. The poorer neighborhoods are concrete. Even the playground is concrete. Mm-hmm. And so I have access to nature, which I'm eternally grateful, especially the river, because I really find that. And I come from, so I'm a Bengali, right? My ancestors come from what is now Bangladesh, and it's a land full of crisscross by rivers and waterways. So I think rivers are in my blood. And so to be able to live in front of a river and walk, every time I walk to work, every time I walk back home, I walk by the river. And just watching her movements, and she's an estuary, so she has different directions of flow. In fact, I found out that Hudson River, which is the main river in Manhattan, the name Hudson, of course, is some guy's name, right? But the original name of the local indigenous people who were the Lenape, Lene Lenape people, they used to call that river Muhyakantak, which means a river that flows both ways. So much more relational than Hudson. So, and the river that I live on, which is East River, also has this. So it's flowing in one direction in the morning and flowing in other direction. The water is higher or lower depending on the tide. So she's very alive and very changeable. And yet there is a rhythm. You can trust that she's always there. But whether those particular rocks are visible or they're underwater depends on the tide in the bay. So old trees, lots of open spaces, but for me particularly, it's that river that's very, very, I call her my sister sometimes, but it's really that kind of profound relation with that river. And actually early during COVID, like when the lockdown had just begun, I would walk by the river often, and the water was so clear. It's not always, because we have like big barges going on the river all the time, so it's all kinds of oils and stuff in the water. And that was a reminder that just like 2 weeks of no human movement, and look how clear the river water is.
I think that was a big thing for so many of us, the lockdown experience, seeing how nature could reassert itself so quickly. And, you know, if we were to succeed in shifting our culture to be a more sustainable culture, one that makes less impact on the land, one that requires us to race around a lot less than we currently do, just how quickly bird life comes back, just how quickly large mammals will come into city centers. So
yes.
It's just, yeah.
Yes.
I actually write about that in the book, and what started the whole story of the book for me was walking during lockdown in a local woods, and all the crows coming in to roost, and just that experience of being a tiny, tiny human and this incredible natural phenomenon happening, which happens every single day, and yet nobody pays it the slightest bit of attention.
Sure.
And just how disconnected we are from these cycles of nature that are going on around us, and how powerful it is to us on so many levels when we start to pay attention to what is happening in the natural world around us.
Powerful and sometimes heartbreaking. Because we have these a stand of dogwood trees at right below our apartment. And these dogwood trees will normally bloom in spring, early spring. They have been blooming on and off through the entire year now because of the climate. And so they were in full bloom last week. And then we had this cold and snow. And today I was walking by and they're all kind of shriveled and browned. And I always worry that to sustain those many flowers, the sap must be running really well. And then there's a freeze like this, that's what will kill these trees. And it's just heartbreaking for me that we have come to a place where a tree doesn't know when to flower. That is, in some ways, epitomizes the degree of harm. And it's just these four or five dogwood trees in a cluster. But I think they tell a bigger story. So as I was walking today, I was like feeling it, like saying sorry. I mean, because I would imagine that the sap is right now frozen in there. Hopefully not. Hopefully the girth is large enough to protect.
So I've got a last question for you, and that is this. Crows became a really important guiding symbol for me when I was writing the book. Do you have a symbol, a something that found you as maybe something from nature, maybe an archetype, some sort of symbol that has been a guiding force for you, and would you feel able to share it?
I have so many. I don't know. Since we were talking earlier, I will stay with the image of the river that I live by, and her different moods and different heights and different. Sometimes there are little whiteheads if there's a lot of wind. And there's that kind of tolerance too. This huge barge is going. And yeah, and this movement back and forth, depending on whether it's whether the tide is coming in or going out, that it flows in different directions.
And do you engage with that in a spiritual way or in a creative way? How do you do that?
I talk to her. I talk to her. I wake up in the morning, and almost the first thing I do is look out the window and just kind of greet her. And see the change of colors in her. See, like in the morning, as the sun rises, the lights are reflected in the river. And then at night, when it's dark, and on the other side, other bank of the river is Manhattan with all its lights, and they all are reflected in the river, shimmer. And then sometimes in the middle of the day, when it's like a hot, sunny day, and you have, it's like the river is encrusted in jewels, and it's free for the taking. You don't have to kill anybody to get those jewels. There are millions of them, but you can't take them. That's the funny part too, right?
Imagine if we lived in a world, in a culture, where people paid attention to the land, all the things on it that was around them, and just based their well-being in that, based their belonging in that, based their knowing in that. I think we would, yeah. We would,
yeah,
solve.
Mary Oliver is my teacher in that, like paying attention. Call her the priestess or the prophetess of attention. Because that's really her invitation. You don't have to do anything big. You don't have to do a massive ritual with 1,000 elements. Just pay attention.
I was literally, before I came on this call with you, I was on Instagram and somebody had shared a video of her reading Wild Geese, you know, a couple of decades ago, but yes. Just how special it was to hear those words that so many of us love and hold so dear in her voice.
Yeah, yeah.
It has been an absolute joy speaking to you, Sushmita. And I really, really hope that we do connect again and talk more, because I'm very sad that you're the other side of the Atlantic to me, because you're somebody I would love to spend time with. Really enjoyed this. So tell me, how can people find out more about you?
They can go to my website. That's probably the easiest way. It's www.onseeing.com,
which is how
I borrowed the title from On Being, Krista Tippett's program.
I love that program. Me too.
I wanted On Seeing as one word, and it was going to cost me like $4,000 for the domain, so I used the hyphen.
Oh, that's lovely to know that you have the connection with her too, because she is one of us, I think, as well.
Big time. In fact, her interview with Mary Oliver is one of the things that I keep going back to again and again.
Me too. And apologies for everybody listening who's just heard me go, me too, but it's really exciting to meet somebody I've never met before who I have so much in common with. So thank you so much, Sushmita,
for joining us,
and thank you for listening.
What a joy it was. I had been looking forward to the conversation, and my goodness, it didn't disappoint. So I really hope you've enjoyed that too. Please do let me know on Instagram at Creative Magic Podcast or at Lucy H. Pierce what you loved about this episode, what your takeaways are. Please be sure to follow the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, tell all your friends about us. And come back again next time for more creative magic.